Broadcasting from the University City.
We are Cambridge 105.
You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests. But we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. We've got a very eclectic show for you today. We'll be hearing from poet Jenny Dunbar talking about her new collection, Thoughts of Time, and historian Glynis Cooper will be talking about her book, Cambridge in the Great War. Our studio guest today, though, is relationship psychologist and writer Susan Quilliam. Hello, Susan.
Hello.
Thank you for coming on the show. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but looking at our guest today, Glynis is a historian who's written a book about history. Jenny's Dunbar is preoccupied with time, and that's very much reflected in her collection of poems. So, are you doing something that you're interested in? Have you always been interested in what makes people tick and relationships? Have you been a bit of a matchmaker?
I've always been interested in relationships. When I was very young, I was quite ill, so that meant that I wasn't doing the running around that a normal 3 or 4 year old would do. But I watched, and I would ask these horribly naive questions like, "Mummy, why does Uncle John never smile at Auntie Claire?" You know, which must have made my parents cringe. But yes, always fascinated. And now I have the best job in the world because my job is all about relationships.
And at what stage did you decide, actually, you know, you're going to make this a career?
I think it sort of crept up on me. I read psychology and English at university and then taught, which is one of the best places to find out about relationships because they're going on all around you. You know, the kids are just fascinating. And then I took a counselling course. I'm not a counsellor now, I'm a coach. And then it just grew from there. I started to write, and writing helped me focus on what was important and what was important. What is important is relationships.
And now you do the two, don't you? You're a broadcaster, a writer, and you see clients. So that's a really nice combination.
It's lovely because you get the face-to-face, which offsets the, I wouldn't say loneliness, but the sort of solitude of being a writer. And then, the two balance each other out.
Lovely. Well, we'll come back and, as I say, give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we'll listen to your first choice of music now. A very upbeat one, Love Me Do, The Beatles. Why this one?
This one because I remember the moment when I first heard this, and I remember thinking, that's wonderful music, and it's about relationships, and I suspect even though I was 12 or 13, I responded to the intimacy of that, and all of a sudden I moved from being a child to being somebody who's interested in adult relationships.
Love me do. Whoa, love me do.
Love Me Do by the Beatles, of course, the first choice of music today in Bookmark from our studio guest, Susan Quilliam. Susan is a relationship therapist and expert in the psychology of relationships. She's an ambassador for Relate Cambridge and in 2015 was named UK Dating Expert of the Year at the UK Dating Awards. She's written 22 books on the subject of relationships, which have been published in 33 countries and 24 languages, and include titles such as Stop Arguing, Start Talking, Staying Together, described by the Times as the only relationship book you'll ever need, and her latest, How to Choose a Partner. In 2008, she revised The Joy of Sex, the classic bestseller, first published in 1972 and written by Alex Comfort. We ought to say up front, of course, if you're listening to this on the podcast, you're listening in the privacy of your own home at any time of the day or night. If you're listening to this live, it's 1 o'clock on Saturday. We will be talking, frankly, about sex and relationships. We won't be using any obscene language or anything, but just a heads up on that. So The Joy of Sex, Susan. Alex Comfort, of course, that classic text. Was that his real name, just by the way?
It was actually his real name, yes.
You are destined to write a book about sex if you've got a name.
A name like Comfort, yes.
How did that come about, that you were asked to revise that?
Well, sadly, Alex died in 2000. The original book was written in 72, and it had been updated. But by 2000, by 2008, when I was invited in, it was looking dated. And
in what way?
Many ways. The science was very basic when he wrote it. We've learned so much more about the science, the biology of sexuality. And also the whole world has changed. I mean, he wrote that book as a man, for men. And although he was ahead of his time in accepting the role of women in sexuality, it was still quite misogynist.
Was it for men? I didn't know that. I wasn't clear on that. It was aimed at men, was it?
He was a GP who saw couples who knew very little about sexuality. And he thought, OK, let's write a book that helps them understand. But of course, back in the 70s, it was the man who took the lead. So the book was for men.
And we all remember the pictures. We remember flicking through them when we got a chance, either in the library or finding it in our parents' bedroom. So the pictures themselves dated it very strongly as a particular period of time.
Yes, and you'll be sad or happy to hear that the new book, the updated book, the man does not have a beard and long hair.
Oh, yes, I have. Yeah, that is right. So has sex changed? Or it's just our attitude? Is that why the need for revision was there? Sex hasn't changed.
Sex hasn't changed.
Expectations have changed.
And in some ways, the meaning. When I first looked at, okay, we didn't rewrite, but we added on about 40 new sections. You know, it's a big change. But when I looked, I thought, well, it's all going to be a lot more permissive. It's got to be going to be a lot more hedonistic, certainly. But there's also been a big change back to Puritanism. And without going into details, a lot of the things that Alex was advocating and thought would come to pass, for example, he reckoned that open relationships would become absolutely standard. Well, sure, you know, there's more permissiveness nowadays, but open relationships are not absolutely standard. And there's awareness of infidelity, and there's awareness of open relationships, which wasn't there in the 70s because they'd never tried it, so they didn't know, you know, whether it was good or bad. So yes, a lot of updating in the social context, a lot of updating in meaning, and I'm not even going to go to what the internet has done for sexuality.
I was going to say, because that is obviously plays a large part, the availability of pornography and the expectations that gives, I guess, young men in particular, as well as just access to online dating and things like that.
Absolutely. I mean, the good side of it is that there is far more information available and good information available, you know, on the internet. But at the same time, as you've just said, there's a dark side to it. And people know that, and people are quite wary of it in a way that I think there was a naivety in the 70s.
But you were asked to revise the book, so people obviously still felt, publishers felt there was still a need for the book, that people would still read it.
Oh, there's a huge need. I mean, the original book sold 6 million copies. We haven't hit that yet, but it's selling fine. And there will always, as you said, sex hasn't changed. There will always be an interest in more. And one of the things about Alex's book, which I was able to offer in the rewrite, was he has a very, very strong voice. A very unusual, very unique voice. And alongside the relationship knowledge that I was offering, I was able to say, I will write in Alex's style. And the nicest comment I ever got about the book was at the launch, Alex's son Nick said that when he read the book, he couldn't tell the difference between Alex's words and mine. That means probably more to me than any comment that's ever been made about any book I've ever done.
That's lovely. And talking about the words there, has the language we use to talk about sex, has that changed?
Yes, I think it has. But one of the things about Alex's original language was it was so unique and so quirky that it's timeless. You know, you can read it and you can't place it. You can't say, oh, yeah, this was written in the 70s. It's just, oh, you know, what's that voice doing there? And words fascinate me. And the challenge of writing in Alex's language fascinated me. It was wonderful.
That was quite an accolade to be asked to do it, isn't it? You must have been thrilled.
Oh, over the moon. In fact, about 10 years earlier, I'd said in passing to a friend who reminded me of it, well, if I was ever asked to rewrite The Joy of Sex, that would be, you know, the peak of my life. And when I was asked, she rang me up and said, well, be careful what you wish for.
Well, we'll be coming back and talking more about The Joy of Sex and sex itself. We'll hear from Jenny Dunbar, first of all. Jenny is an actor and performer. Her first poetry anthology, Thoughts of Time, was published last year. She's also written short stories and novels. So I asked Jenny, what does poetry offer her as a writer that the other forms don't?
I've always written poetry ever since I was quite tiny. It is a concise form, and I think there is a great satisfaction when one gets it right to find the right rhythm, the beat. It's the musicality, I think, in the language that one is trying to turn so that it communicates to the reader in quite a different way. There's obviously poetry in prose, and I've always leant towards the musicality in words. I guess taking a thought and concentrating it into a more concise form of expression is something that's always appealed to me.
And this collection focuses on issues to do with nature and the passing of time. Are those issues that preoccupy you?
Time is a universal thing, but it's also a unique experience. We all have our time, and that has become more significant for me. And also the nuances and perspective in time fascinated me recently over the last few years. That's where I got the inspiration for the anthology, hence an anthology, not a collection. Sure, I think time passing, time present, time future. I'm working as a passive observer, if you like, and writing about that.
And why has that become more significant for you?
Well, probably because time is passing and one isn't writing from youth. A little experience makes a lot of difference.
And there is a wistfulness and a nostalgia and a slight bitterness sometimes in your poetry. Would these have been poems that you would have written 20 years ago, 30 years ago, even 10 years ago?
What poems were you thinking of particularly? It's interesting that you talk about bitterness. I mean, I try to think of every nuance, every perspectives and nuance are very important. There is certainly disappointment in some of them, not necessarily my disappointment.
Poem When? There's an edge of bitterness
yes,
in that
yes,
one.
Yes, yes, yes.
When black becomes the only stuff inside my dreams with which to clothe my stubborn form. Bitter is perhaps too strong, but there's a
celebration at the end, isn't there? Because there's something wonderful to resort to, possibly.
I suppose that's maybe an age thing as well, that, you know, you can look back on these things now. There's a lesson learned.
I think it's also, again, talking about the observer. One observes other people and how time passes or how time seems to be with them and how it has affected them.
As you say, this is an anthology, not a collection. Are you working towards a collection?
Yes, I am. I'm halfway through a collection of poems on a variety of themes. That's another interesting departure.
Different process, I would imagine, to putting together an anthology.
It is, that's right. The anthology is a very concentrated expression, I suppose, about time. And there was a certain... Having finished it, I wrote it over several months. It's a much more relaxed process doing the collection. You know, there's a sense of relief in some senses. But then when you see something and you want to write it down, writing is sometimes a very highly, highly emotionally charged process. So in a way, I've got more time. to create the collection.
Some people might think it would be the other way around in a way, because when it's a collection, there's a theme that links all the poem, or a message, whereas an anthology, you're putting your work together. Putting together a collection means that you're thinking along certain lines all the time as you write.
I suppose intuitively I might be doing that. I don't necessarily feel quite like that about it, but that's just me.
Is writing poetry still quite a new thing for
you? No. I've always written poetry, ever since I was little. I actually wrote a poem before I wrote a story.
And have you shared that poetry, or is this a big step, sharing your poetry?
Yes, this is the first time that I've actually had poetry published.
And how does it feel? Because some of these poems strike me as very personal. I know you might be speaking in a poetic voice or a character voice, but they are quite personal looking back.
It's important to make oneself vulnerable. I think you have to, when you're expressing yourself, you have to find a moment of truth or several moments of truth. And so, yes, they are. They're personal, but not to an extent where I'm doing a therapy thing. It's writing about how I see landscape, people. The first poem, which in fact is called Last, started me off on the anthology. I was researching for a novel I was writing, which was about war. And we went to a high wood in northern France. A terrible battle was fought there over quite a few days, weeks. And we walked through the wood, which is now, it's regenerated, they've replanted. But there was a last tree, and that tree had a little fence around it. And it was the last tree. It was the tree that was left there at the end of all this horror. And there was nothing so eerily poignant on a late February afternoon than to discover that tree. And that started me off.
And how do you decide what form to write in? Because there's some that are quite different.
That's interesting. Certainly, for me, I find stepping out of the conventional form quite exciting, as long as one turns it, like you turn clay, I'm a potter, or wood. If you turn it so the shape is sound and you retain the beat, the weight, the rhythm, the quality of the words. I think it's fine to step out of the convention. A lot of my poems in that anthology are not in a conventional form. Two or three of them are based on short stories that I wrote, and I've turned those into poems. Mrs. Rupert, for example, is a lady who has Alzheimer's. I've given her a fictitious name, but she represents that going into confusion and dementia. And in the poem, she is saved. I mean, she is very, very confused, but fortunately she finds herself in the hands of people who will protect her. That was a short story. Hostage Leaving Stockholm, and Elizabeth and Frederica, Two Deaths in a French Village. Those two poems were originally short stories.
Are you going to read some now for us?
The first poem I'd like to read is called The Presence. It's a reflection on time gone. Some leave us and at their passing place a mark, a touch in the room. Passages about the place in which they dwelt seem still travelled calmly, and with a routine purpose, kindly. Objects pierce the eye, inanimate in neutrality. Those now left at one with life look up and out expectantly, glimpse the basket by the garden door, half full with apples, last year's orchard's harvest, safe kept and redolent. Whilst laughter somewhere else tricks and makes believe it is not true, light gathers in discreet corners, upon books and tables, playing where framed dawn and twilight turn suddenly motionless and dull. The vase against the window shelf becomes a lesser image of itself. The mark absents itself fleetingly and brings the possibility of release, but returning outlines the cruel vanity of hope. She passed and was gone, left, disappeared. Uncanny nothingness remained in her wake. Only her words inside my head, her voice outraged, sad, funny, concerned and wise, her words saying all at unexpected times and hours. Perhaps I sense her watching from afar on distant hills and windy shores, Maybe the star that winked was she, newborn, and travelling with the light towards me, infinite, and oh, so bright. And the next very short one is a huge contrast to that. It shows how a second of time can turn everything around. It's called Split. And to turn back, before the words were spoken, the moment when we sipped tea slowly in contemplation of the everyday, when we agreed nonchalantly that the rumour was barren of significance, and if it were, its significance was a little thing, a misapprehension, an opinion, not a fact. To bathe in the innocence of the moment, and to be able to say, this never was, didn't happen, we have not heard. Everything will be the same, our lives splitting and burning at the second's turning.
That was Jenny Dunbar there talking about her poetry anthology, Thoughts of Time, which is published by Austin Macaulay. My studio guest today on Bookmark is relationship therapist Susan Quilliam and author. Susan, Jenny there, you know, being very frank and saying, well, look, time is preoccupying me because I've got less time. I'm older now. I'm guessing that in your job, the issues that are presented to you and that you present to your reader, you present to all ages, do you? And come from all ages.
Yes, but there are certain life stages where relationships are perhaps more at the forefront, or intimate relationships. So the 20s, when people are looking for a long-term partner. Maybe the 40s, when the first divorce. And then there is a surge now of people looking for a later life relationship. You know, maybe a late life divorce, children have grown up. And I get people coming looking for relationships at that point, or looking to turn relationships around or leave them. So, you know, maybe my youngest coaching client has been 25, but my oldest has been in her 60s.
And are people older and wiser? Or are this, do they make the same mistakes throughout their life?
Oh, I think people do gain wisdom. They certainly do. But then the challenges of life possibly get bigger. And in later life, you're facing death. And now we don't necessarily believe that there's going to be anything after. So having a good relationship becomes even more important.
And you've written how many books? 22 books. 22 books, yes. On these subjects. Who decides the topics for the books?
Oh, publishers come to me. Or I go to publishers. The latest book, the How to Choose a Partner, is from an organisation I work for called the School of Life, and I teach a course there, so I train people. And the book came out of the course, and not only my thoughts, but the thoughts of the students who'd taken the course.
And how do you approach something like that when you're approaching a book about relationships? Because it's like a piece of string, I guess, you can just keep going and going. How do you structure it? You know, what processes do you go through thinking, we'll have a chapter on this, we'll have a chapter on that?
I've looked at my own process of writing really since I was quite young. And I've realised that what I do is, if you imagine a line going from left to right, a timeline, about half of that is spent on the research and the reorganisation. So I will gather material, gather material, gather material, until I find I'm not finding much new. Then I will reorganise, 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 until I know more or less what's going in each paragraph. And then I spend quite a short period of time, very intensively, usually no more than 3 or 4 weeks, but, you know, writing, eating, sleeping, and doing not much else. And then I edit, 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 so that, in fact, the writing, what an outsider, a non-writer might call the writing bit, takes up a very short period of time, but intensive. The preparation and the editing so that it's what I want. And I really, really resonated with what Jenny said about the sound. You know, as I'm going, at the editing stage in particular, it needs to sound right. You know, it needs to feel right in my head, as well as having the facts and the insights that I want to convey.
And do you have a reader in your mind?
I have a number of readers in my mind. I spend quite a bit of time at the beginning, in that first 50%, talking to people who would read the book, so that I've sort of integrated them. And by the time I come to write the book, that's not conscious. I'm not thinking I'm writing for Mary or I'm writing for John. I'm writing for all the people who have ever sat in front of me in a class and all the people who have ever sat in front of me in the coaching room. And I've got a sort of amalgam of them. And there's very much a sense of, OK, I've written this. Would it feel right to them? Would it feel right to the person I'm writing for? So there's definitely a feeling, a check, an emotional check on whether it feels right and an emotional check on whether it sounds right.
Because you will have people at all stages of lives, won't you, reading your book, and at all stages of relationships, I guess, and it has to feel right and relevant to them.
Yes, and you can do that a lot with framing. You can say at the beginning of the book and through, and you can make sure that you're referring to different ages and stages. But a lot of my books, not The Joy of Sex, but How to Choose a Partner, for example, the main market for that is that sort of 25 through to 45 age range. Other people will read it, but that's my main market.
And is there a key to a good self-help book, do you think, if I can call your books those? Is there something that one thing that makes it work?
If it helps. That sounds very naive, but if people are coming to me, and it's one of the reasons why I liked writing the book, because it was based on the courses, because people would come to me after the courses, they were leaving the room and going, that's really great, you know, I really enjoyed that. And then I'll build that into my courses, that at the end of each class, everybody says something that they found useful. And that gets picked up and taken into the next book I write.
OK, well, let's hear second choice of music. It's actually spoken word. Mm. It's Shakespeare's Sonnet 116, read by the wonderful Judi Dench. Why this one?
Two reasons. Firstly, because an awful lot of people that I coach and an awful lot of people I talk to think that love is around romance. And it is. You know, I'm passionate about falling in love. I've done it myself many times. But it's also about standing in love. That feeling that, OK, things may go wrong and people change, but you're going to hang in there, not in an abusive relationship, of course, but you will accept that a relationship will have difficult bits. So that's the first reason that's what this sonnet speaks to. The second is, I love Shakespeare. I not only love reading him, but I love acting him, and I love... I'm actually part of a theatre company based in Cambridge, and we love acting Shakespeare. It's one of our joys.
Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love, which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with a remover to remove. Oh, no. It is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be error and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105. Studio guest today is relationship psychologist and writer Susan Quilliam. You were talking about romance there just before we went into Shakespeare's sonnet. It's good to hear you talk about romance, because I suppose, you know, we talk about psychology and the mechanics of sex and theory, and at the heart of it all is love and romance. It's that indefinable thing that almost you can't measure scientifically.
You can't measure it scientifically, but one of the really exciting things about writing self-help books at the moment is that there's a lot of science that is helping us discover what helps us to love better. And, you know, it's one of the things I try to do is to pass on that scientific wisdom, the psychological wisdom in a way that non-scientists like me can understand.
Because I know you said nobody teaches us to love.
No, it's not only that we don't have lessons in love at school. And don't get me started on how they, at school, they are delivering as much as they can about how to run relationships, but the funding isn't there. Don't get me started on that. However, as parents, as adults, I don't think we talk enough to children about the difficulties of relationships. You know, not in front of the children. And it's something that, yeah, I don't write books for children. I don't write books for teenagers. But one of my passions is encouraging people to talk to their kids about love's hard. You know, this is not easy. It's not, you know, the way you see it in women's magazines or even in men's magazines. Love's a hard path.
But do you think that's changed over time? And I certainly know when I was growing up, you know, my parents separated and then divorced. Nobody talked about it. It was not in any books. No, it was not on TV. It was represented nowhere. There was a stigma, a shame about it. Yeah. Whereas now, it perhaps because it's more common, but it features in children's TV and children's books. Children talk about it openly at school. Has it changed?
I think it has changed and changed for the better. But again, we don't talk to children about the process of love. You know, my parents didn't talk to me. My parents stayed together, but it wasn't an altogether happy marriage. And nobody ever said to me, you know, there are ways through this. You know, there was nobody I could turn to. Maybe that's why I'm writing these books. There was nobody I could turn to say, I know Mum and Dad aren't happy, but, you know, what could they do about it?
And how much of yourself do you use in your writing and your work? Because you've got to keep a little, well, quite a lot back, I would imagine. And yet everything you think and feel comes from your own experience, obviously.
I think you've expressed it very well. I don't talk much about my own life, not only for myself, but also because I have partners and I have friends who I would be, you know, selling up the river if I did, you know. But this is not about me. This is my being a filter for, if you like, social wisdom. On the other hand, I try to be very open about the fact that, yeah, you know, I've had failed relationships. Actually, I wouldn't say failed. I've had relationships that have ended. And I hope I'm quite open in what I say and in what I write about the fact that I believe love is wonderful and love is hard.
Why did you change that from failed relationships to relationships that have ended?
Because I was wrong to use the word failed, because I think that if people try hard at relationships, there's no such thing as a failed relationship. There can be a relationship that hurts you deeply. There can be a relationship that disappoints you deeply. And you can come out of a relationship better, but you can also come out quite wounded. But as long as we've tried, I don't think there's any such thing as failure.
And if if we think of it as failure, presumably that affects how we're going to the next one.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Right, thank you. We're coming back to you to talk more about love and romance and sex and all those kinds of things. We'll take a sidestep for a moment to listen to Glynis Cooper. Glynis is an archaeologist, librarian and novelist with a passion for local history. During the last 15 years, she has researched and written over a dozen local history books. Cambridge in the Great War examines how the city changed from 1914 to 1918. When I met Glynis last year, I asked her if prior to the outbreak of war in 1914, it would have been obvious to the people of Cambridge that something was afoot.
You had a very politically aware populace in Cambridge, especially as the university were here, and they knew that there was a situation of unrest on the continent. They followed the politics and the newspapers closely, and I think they knew the inevitability when it occurred. They were waiting for it. They weren't sidetracked as some other towns and cities perhaps were by more parochial matters.
Would they have been able to see it around them? Were there visual clues?
Since 1912, there have been a number of military manoeuvres carried out in the Cambridgeshire countryside, and people have been told that this was just normal army training. But the local territorial regiments believed otherwise because they felt that it was training over and above what was normal, and they were uncertain. And coupled with the situation that was rapidly developing on the continent after the assassination of the Archduke, I think they feared that the worst was coming.
And in terms of local men signing up and joining the army, was there a good response from Cambridge?
There was an excellent response, both from the university and from the local men. A really initial excellent response. The war began in August, and that was just a few weeks before the New Year's academic intake for the university. And normally the university would expect to have about 4,000 students, and several hundred signed up. Several hundred also signed up from the town. There was a lot of initial enthusiasm, especially among the territorials, I think, who were relieved in a way that now it had happened. They knew what was happening. They had recruiting officers in the town. They also decided that Cambridge, because of its large open areas, should be, if you like, a central recruiting area for the eastern counties.
You mentioned the university there. What impact did the war have on the university?
Initially, not too bad. I think after compulsory conscription came in, where every male between the age of 18 and 41 had to go and fight if they were medically fit to do so, that did have a severe impact. In the year before the war started, which was 1913 to 1914, the university had 4,000 students. In the last year of the war, academically, it would have started in October 1917, gone through to 1918, they had 400. And that had a great knock-on effect on both industries in Cambridge and also on learning and the way that the TRIPOS examinations were conducted.
And the buildings themselves, how were they used?
Initially, there didn't seem to be too much impact. Where it really hurt was the lodging houses, because there were a large number of lodging houses providing accommodation for students in the town, 4,000 of them. The lodging house keepers were often not the owners of the houses. They were put in there, if you like, to do the day-to-day management. The owners of the houses saw no reason when the war started not to put up the rent in the normal annual increase, which put the lodging house keepers, if you like, between a rock and a hard place, because they were not the students to take their rooms and pay the rent, but they still had to pay rent to whoever actually owned the house and rates to the local council.
There was a rumour that it had been agreed not to bomb the university. Is that true?
Yes, it is, actually. The Kaiser had a great affection for Cambridge. He had visited the town, and I believe that members of his family had been members of the university. And, of course, there was an enormous scare in 1914, 1915 and 1916, in fact, with the Zeppelin warships over the eastern counties. And one of Cambridge's neighbouring towns, Bury St Edmunds, was quite badly hit. But although there are instances of the Zeppelins flying over Cambridge, there's actually an image of one flying over Emmanuel College. The Kaiser had said that Cambridge was not to be touched. And strangely enough, that had a knock-on effect, because in World War II, Hitler also ordered that Cambridge was not to be bombed.
But nevertheless, people of Cambridge must have prepared for attack.
The way they prepared for attack was either on land or for troops landing on the east coast and coming across. There hadn't been the phenomena of aerial warfare before. It was the first time that people in their home country that wasn't occupied could actually be attacked by an outside enemy. It was very, very frightening for them. Many people couldn't get their heads around the fact that these huge airships could come over and they could just be dead in an instant.
And we're 2016 now. If I took you back in a time machine and we walked through Cambridge and it was 1916, what would it look like? What difference would we see from today?
In 1916, they had a lot of problems with rising food prices, with the value of wages going down, with lack of affordable housing, with problems of funding in health and education, the county council and the borough council in Cambridge spent most of the war quarrelling contentedly like an old married couple as to whom should be responsible for which road repairs. But the problems that I've enumerated, really similar to the economic problems of today. And I found on occasion when I was researching the 1916 newspapers in Cambridge Central Library, I had to keep checking the date because the problems were so similar. I'm thinking, I haven't picked up the wrong reel by mistake, have I?
And what about the open spaces in Cambridge? How were they used?
Because they'd got these huge open spaces, probably the biggest of which is Parker's Peace, and they needed a central point where they could assemble all the military and give them brief training and drill them. They turned Parker's Peace, in fact, into an enormous army camp, but they also did it with Midsummer Common, Jesus Common, the Lammas Land. It was good in one way because it brought soldiers into the town, it brought trade into the town. The bad side was they made an absolute mess of the open land that they camped on, the bivouac.
And researching this book, Glynis, what have been your main sources?
I'm not sure what it's called now. I think it's the Cambridge Evening News, maybe its current title. But it goes right the way back. Because if you think about it, if you are living away and you want to know what's going on in your hometown, you will ask somebody to send you the daily or weekly paper. The daily and weekly provincial papers tended to concentrate more on what living conditions for people were like. The national dailies would maybe give a summary, but they were all more interested in the politics and what was going on in the battles. It was the larger scene, if you like. But if you're looking at what it was like to be in a certain town during those 4 years and how the people there coped with the deprivations, the restrictions and the hardships, the food shortages, then the local paper was the place to go.
And was there one particular fact that you found out during your research that astonished you more than any other?
I think that the fact that astonished me most, especially in a city like Cambridge, was with all the men fighting away, it's a well-known fact that the women stepped into the men's shoes. They kept the home fires burning. They not only sort of cooked and cleaned and cared for the children, they did the jobs that men couldn't do because they were away fighting at the front, and they did them very efficiently, and that was the reason for them being given the vote in 1918. But there was a tremendous amount of anti-female feeling. Now, if you have a very, say, traditional northern town, that I could understand. But in Cambridge, it did surprise me. The farming communities were particularly against women helping out on the farms, and they were the obvious source of labour. The farmers campaigned non-stop for their sons to come back from the front every year at harvest time. For the first two summers of the war, 1915, 1916, this happened. 1917, David Lloyd George was Prime Minister, and he was getting fed up with this. So the Women's Land Army was formed, and it was a case of you will take female labour or you will go without. There was also a lot of, shall I say, antisocial feeling about females. The mayor of Cambridge in, I think, 1917 was the master of Corpus Christi, and he was incredibly anxious that girls on the streets shouldn't, and I quote, defile the clean and pure soldiers who are fighting for us abroad.
So this is Cambridge and the Great War. What's next for you?
I have just finished a book on the city of Manchester in the First World War. I was given a series of six commissions to write on various towns and cities in the Great War. Manchester is totally, totally different from Cambridge because the cotton industry was big in Manchester. It was known as Cottonopolis, the hatting industry. Manchester also had a massive engineering industry, and that it did share with Cambridge because Cambridge had the scientific instrument companies, but they were both equally important in trying to defeat the German military machine and also to come up with new forms of protection for the chemical warfare that was being used and anti-aircraft guns. And it wasn't until 1917 that they actually managed to find the technology to shoot down a Zeppelin. And once they did, that was the end of the Zeppelin attacks, because the Germans were just flying into suicide missions.
That was Glynis Cooper talking about her book Cambridge in the Great War, which is published by Pen and Sword. You're listening to Bookmark. Studio guest is Susan Quilliam, relationship expert. Just listening to Glynis, obviously that's her passion, history. You can hear it in her voice, can't you? I'm just wondering, I know your passion is your work and your writing, but have you got a release valve somehow? Because you're hearing quite intense things, I would imagine, a lot of the time. What do you do to deal with those?
I act. I mentioned earlier that I'm a member of the In Situ company, and we train people in acting skills, but we also perform. We've got a new, lovely new project starting at the moment on the Shakespeare play Measure for Measure, and we're starting a weekly course on that. But if anybody, can I mention the website?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, if anybody wants to know more about the courses and our performances, our productions, it's simply In Situ Theatre. That's the website, and I love it.
And can you switch off, or do you look at something like Measure for Measure and you think, oh, well, the relationship's interesting there, I've got something I can take back, you know, are you still learning?
I don't think you can look at anything without looking at the relationships. I guess that's why it's a passion for me. But it's very easy to switch off when you're, you know, running around Iron Age Fort up at Wandlebury Common, or you're, you know, balancing on one leg whilst declaiming from Romeo and Juliet, as I have done on occasions. No, it's a complete break for me. It's lovely.
And is there something for you there about making yourself vulnerable? Because people make themselves vulnerable in front of you all the time. And by acting, you do open yourself up, don't you?
Yeah, I suspect also there's something about a completely different context. It's not that when I'm doing coaching that I have to be controlled all the time. As one of my early trainers said to me, it is perfectly possible to help people even when you are crying too. I haven't done it often in the 30 years. But at the same time, being able to say, yeah, for this 3 hours a week, or, you know, for this period of the performance, I'm interacting with people in a completely different way. That's great.
And you also teach about relationships in the workplace, don't you? And interpersonal relationships, yeah, at work.
Yeah, because although intimate relationships are where my focus are, the challenges of the workplace, I think, can I say, particularly when there's conflict, they can totally impact on somebody's life. And it's very difficult in the workplace, because it's difficult to open up in the same way as you might do to a partner or to a friend. There are certain barriers, there are certain boundaries. So yes, very often with my clients, I try to help them navigate workplace situations, and they can be quite difficult, quite stressful.
Well, there's often a power relationship there in there as well, isn't there, if it's a boss and
there's often a power relationship. And I mean, in Cambridge, for example, there are a lot of quite small startup companies where an expert, you know, somebody who is really good at their job, is now, as they succeed and their company grows, they're moving into management. And that's a real challenge. I often say to people, no, you're the talent. You don't need to be the manager as well.
What a nice job you have. You must see people's lives turn around. Not in every case, I suppose, but you are helping them move to a different stage of their life, navigate change.
For me, it's the best job in the world. I really love it. And it's a total privilege. And one of the joys that I have is, over this past year, two of the couples, I work with individuals as well as couples, but two of the couples that I've been working with have moved on and have had babies. So I have two babies that I've helped bring into this world. And I'm not even a midwife. I'm an emotional midwife, maybe.
A couple counselling, I bet, is absolutely fascinating, isn't it?
Well, strictly speaking, I'm a coach rather than a counsellor or a therapist. They'd shoot me at Related. They heard me saying I was a therapist. And coaching is different. Coaching is saying, OK, let's have a conversation about this. So it's very practical, very pragmatic, and very, very rewarding.
Well, it's been lovely chatting to you, Susan. What are you working on at the moment? Have you got a book that you're writing at the moment?
I haven't got a book I'm writing at the moment, but I'm teaching a course at the School of Life about relationship endings, and that could well be the next project.
And your School of Life, you mentioned there, they've published quite a lot of your books, that's right, as well as Relate.
Relate published my books. The School of Life has one book that I've written, and the others are spread among whatever publishing company was most relevant for the book at the time.
Excellent. And if you want to find out more about your work, you've got your website, susanquilliam.com.
Yes.
We'll come back to you in a moment because we're going to play out with your final choice of music. But let me just remind people, we've got next show is in February, the second Saturday in February. Our studio guest on that show will be the author Tom Connolly, talking about his novel Men Like Air, which has been described as a love letter to New York. We'll also be hearing from Claire Cox Stanley. She's worked on Schott's Almanac series and many other different books. And I'm interviewing a dame. How about this? Dame Gillian Beer, critic and academic. She'll be talking about her latest book on Lewis Carroll. If you want to hear any of the old bookmarks, then go to the Cambridge 105 website, cambridge105.fm. And I think every episode of Bookmark is up there from time immemorium. Okay, we're signing out now with your last choice of music, Susan. This is Schubert String Quintet in CD 956, but the adagio, you were very definite about that.
I was very definite about the adagio.
Why this?
For two reasons. Firstly, it's the most beautiful piece of music. I can never listen to it without tearing up. And secondly, because you asked me what I do to relax, all as well as theatre. I can't read novels. They're too close to my day job. But I do read crime novels. And I watch crime on television. And one of my favourites is Morse. And in the very last programme of Morse, Morse faces his own death. And I believe there's a very close link between love and death. He faces his own death and they play this piece. And, yeah, it's very moving. And I think that if we are capable of love, we're probably capable of facing our own death and vice versa. Thank you.